Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and I am here with star of TV and film, Michael Kester.
And both of us are stars of TV and film today.
I think it's just film, though. I don't think. TV is like, TV went from an
undesirable. I watched it on a TV.
There you go, TV and film. Of screens both small and large.
Yeah, there you go.
How the fuck are you doing now that you've seen director's cuts?
I have a lot of questions and a lot to say.
We should get to it pretty quick. Today is an amazing day in that it is finally time to talk about director's cut and everybody wants some, exclamation point.
I was going to say there's two for some reason. Yeah.
Well, there goes my questions answered right at the top of the show. What order do you want to
do? Well, it wasn't even called
these,
that when I was in it.
We got to get to the bottom of some things here. What order do you want to do these?
Man, I don't know. Let's do yours first. I feel like there's more information.
All right.
It'll be denser.
Okay. So
I've just got Wyatt Russell stories. So
24-ish minutes. I don't know what's going to happen with time. I have no idea actually what's going to happen with the whole show. But
time is a flat circle.
Okay. Well, thanks. That's no more helpful than when you text it to me when I ask you if you want to record the show or not. But thank you for that. So we got some big asks today on the show.
Yeah.
One is don't spoil yourself on these movies. Go see them because it will make us feel good.
Mm-hmm.
I am, as I wasted all of your time with before we recorded, actively checking the director's cut numbers to see if people watch this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very exciting to me.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I hope people are really excited about, aside from being spoiled on the two films that we're involved in, is I think by the end of this show, we're going to find out which one of us made more money on our respective films.
I already know the answer to that.
So do I.
Wait, do I get to start at zero or do I have to start in
no,
the hole?
You okay, can't start
then,
at zero.
Well, then it's just how much of a factor to me. How many zeros are between you and I? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you even knew this. I think you know this. But because of my big-time Hollywood string pulling, you received a credit in director's cut as well.
I did see that.
You are credited on both of these films today.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm the big shot today.
Why I like to think this is a Michael Kester double feature.
I'm the big shot and you're the head shot.
All right. So listen, if you haven't ever listened to the show before, these are movies that we did some stuff on. We were on the sets of the movies. We may or may not have stories. I might have forgotten all of mine because we made this film like 100 years ago. But we have arrived at the moment where the whole plan for this podcast for 10 years has been make some movies that Fed gets to talk about on the show. So we sort of didn't do that plan very well. But
no.
But the other thing I wanted to ask before we roll into this, just because of the stupid timing, I know, and this sucks, that I'm both trying to get people to watch not one, not two, but two movies and a Patreon. It is the very end emergency of the last month before we have to start talking internally about the next year of the show.
Right.
So
sun's getting awful low, double feature. Just keep petting that rabbit, double feature.
All there is to say is go to patreon.com/double feature. Don't laugh through the Patreon. This is the most important part of the show. If you learn nothing else on this show today, if you can only walk away and do one thing right now, it is go to patreon.com/double feature. Let double feature live to fight another day. We got way too much to talk about, both on this show and just forever. So we need your help to keep doing that. patreon.com/double feature. While you're on the Patreon, dig around with your bonus incentives and listen to the last time we had to do this, and probably more successfully, on Rob Zombie's 31, a film I had even less to do with than today's film, if possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible. Having said that, I might actually have something to say. How do we do director's cut?
Okay, well, I'm going to just start by asking you a couple questions, and you can answer them as you want to. But I know that a big thing that you wanted to talk about too was sort of like, you're so deeply immersed in the world of director's cut that you don't know what that movie looks like anymore.
I have no clue.
Yeah. So instead of even give you an insight into that, I'm just going to blindside you with a question. Why does your movie suck? No, I'm kidding. But thanks. I mean, that's the point, right? I just thought it'd be a funny way to say that. No. Yeah. Yeah. Just scare you. But like, no, I know that that's the premise, is that it's like supposed to be bad. But what I thought about that, and this is interesting, is that when you have a film that adopts the super, super dense premise of Penn Jillette / Herbert Blount's director's cut, it's really interesting to figure out if it matters if you have a, quote, good movie. You know what I mean?
Like, that's part of...
Where does that come in?
I don't know if I have such a hard time determining if this is successful or what it looks like or how to describe it, because I spent so much time with it and seeing it in different forms, or if it's because the movie is so fucking confusing because the thing it's doing, it's both rare and a thing we say every episode on this show.
Mm-hmm.
That a movie like the movie today has never existed before.
Mm-hmm.
But the experiments that this movie really dives into are the very experiments. It's beyond what would it be like if a film did this, or, you know, what might arise. But really, if we do this, is it still even a fucking movie?
Right.
That's the level of experimentation.
Sure.
Which is pretty exciting for me as a person who's watched 1,000 films on this show.
Yeah.
Actually, I think we have a running tally somewhere. I don't know. It's more than 1,000. I don't know.
It's 1,100 plus. It's outrageous, that number.
Yeah. I mean, Meta doesn't even begin to... We've done Meta Movie, Snore, Meta Movie, whatever. Mm-hmm. Meta Movies have been done a million times on this show. That's like... Mm-hmm. It's like you've never seen a found footage movie before. No, there's a billion of them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is... beyond meta, it's a director's commentary with a fictional element.
I mean, it's so tricky. It's one of those things that, I mean, it gives me a similar sensation to Hardcore Henry when the movie starts. It is jarring in a way where it becomes apparent very quickly that I have to view this differently than I've viewed something before.
Yeah.
Just with the opening credits and the voiceover, I'm kind of just like, where in the layers am I watching this from?
Yeah.
You have to accept that Knocked Off is a thing, and then immediately, subsequently accept that you'll never see that thing.
Uh-huh.
But you just have to accept it and kind of try and guess how that goes. Then you have this voiceover, which is the voiceover over a film that is a re-edit / recut of Knocked Off. So that's layer three already. Because there's Knocked Off, and then there's Herbert Blount's Knocked Off. And now you're watching the director's cut of Herbert Blount's Knocked Off.
Yeah.
Which is not actually, that's an unreliable narrator. So now you're at a fourth level where you know that that guy's not telling you the truth.
The thing that, and we once again say this every show, but it may be never more true, that not only would you get spoiled if you haven't seen director's cut, but I'm not even sure if you could follow this conversation if you've watched it. You may need to see it a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's primer-like math is so complicated or anything, but it's just doing a lot.
Yeah.
And there is no possible... This should not be your introduction to director's cut.
Mm-hmm.
This should... Look, I've given up on telling people what to do with their spoilers and their lives, but I can't see any value anyone would get to listening to this conversation before they see the movie.
Sure.
So if a mind fuck of a movie sounds interesting, go watch that before doing anything with this.
Mm-hmm.
When I first got introduced to this, it was through the script.
Mm-hmm.
And the script was much different. And this was the first movie I was ever on a set of that was worth millions of dollars and done like a movie and not with four friends.
Mm-hmm.
In a barn or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. That was a garage.
Well, I didn't specifically mean that, but then the picture in my head I painted was, oh yeah, that movie. The double feature movie available on the Patreon. the pilot, the commercial, the most unnecessary Kickstarter video that will feature the movie. So a lot of this, the whole industry, I was a complete outsider. I didn't live in LA. I didn't know any of these people. The only person I'd ever met was Penn. I'd never met Adam. And then I came down here with no sense of what I was really going to do on the movie and ended up being here for, I believe, all but the first day. All but one day that they shot with the skeleton crew in somebody's house that I don't know if people are supposed to know whose house that is. So when that's part of what makes this tricky to understand now is when you're introduced at a really surface kind of early pitch level, somebody tells you what the movie's about. If you see the movie, nobody's going, you're not reading the back of the DVD jacket. I mean, maybe you are, but you're not given this glorious introduction that tells you what you're about to see. And then whether that's actually in the movie or not, this is a trick I'm struggling with personally as I'm writing this other movie right now, is I know what the movie's about. I know what I tell someone the movie's about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's actually what it's about if they just read the script. I don't know what the fuck they get out of it.
That's something that, I mean, you already mentioned it, but that's something that we struggled with a lot with the double feature movie. It's something we struggled with a lot with the Kicksaw videos.
Yeah.
It's like you and I have these discussions off the air, or just you and I. I mean, you and I speak a different language. Like, have you ever tried to show somebody one of our text conversations?
I always think they're funny and no one understands what the fuck.
Yeah. I'll just show something to somebody and it'll be like, you know, I heard that they cast Jamie Foxx in Spawn, and your response is, that's an expensive movie. And I laugh uproariously and they go, I don't understand the joke.
Yeah.
And I go, well, you would have had to know him for 10 years and speak to him regularly about just films for that whole time.
You develop a shorthand with the crew and, you know, in a movie that's crazy like this, you have to have a pretty good shorthand. But the thing that is probably the most exciting and also kind of terrifying about the whole journey of Director's Cut is that I really watched these guys experiment as they were making it.
Yeah.
Because they had a pretty good handle on what it was. And then you start making it and you start having to problem solve, right? Mm-hmm. Things start not going right on the day and you have to swap out elements and whatever. And so you start making these almost gut instinct judgment calls, the very judgment calls you've trained yourself to be the only human who can make as a director or as a writer, as somebody making calls on this film, like, say, Adam was. Adam was there, obviously, every day, whereas Penn wasn't. Penn really kind of handed off the movie. You know, he viewed...
Yeah, that was actually a question that I had, too.
He viewed that as something he had to do. He wrote this script. The script was very bloody, so much more a hard, almost horror. French extreme style horror film than what we ended up shooting, and then even more so what ended up being in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely, I mean, so just from the arc that I remember seeing, so the original URL for the webpage was Make Penn Bad, right?
Well, and that was a big part of it too, is he really wanted to play a villain.
Which I was curious if you happen to know if he feels like he's played a villain to this day.
Yeah, I mean, when that was the first shock that I got is when I showed up and saw, actually, I think somebody had texted me a picture of once they got into costume.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't been involved in any pre-production. I lived in Silicon Valley. I talked to these guys on email and I was basically like, hey, I want to come hang out on your movie. And if I'm useful, cool and whatever. So I didn't see any of the lead up and I wouldn't even known what to look for. And then when I got there, Penn's villain, which I had seen before, Will Barrett had actually shot a teaser
for
this movie for funding.
With the like really harsh, like creepy lighting.
Yeah, right? Very horror stuff, which at the time I didn't even, you know, I went on to make a movie with Will, Disposition.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know he was involved until we started working on Disposition. And I was telling him about Director's Cut and he was like, oh, I shot this and I shot the end credits scene. And so that was really, really funny.
Mm-hmm.
I never would have thought. But Will Barrett, as we've talked about, shot almost all of Adam Green's films.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, Penn shot that to be much more like the original script. He's playing a villain, a very bad pen.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I showed up, Penn had really slipped into this character that's way more kind of Tiny Tim-esque. And that character continued to develop in humorous and interesting ways,
yeah.
especially in the VO later.
Sure.
And so that's when I started getting this inkling of, oh, the movie's changing. And the thing you, that was my first insight into the thing that you write down is not the movie.
Yeah.
It's where you begin.
Yeah.
It's a version of the movie that probably in every single fucking case never gets made.
Well, and that's one of the things too that I think is kind of interesting about, just to go back to the film itself and less from the production standpoint, but like, it's really difficult to view Herbert Blount as a bad guy. And, you know, going into Director's Cut, just from, you know, you and I having these conversations on the show, off the show, whatever, I knew that it was comical. I'd seen an image of him in one of the suits running around in the scene where you got super murdered.
Sure.
And I remember seeing that and being like, yeah, that's definitely a different vibe, but I don't know, maybe it's not. And
well, that's what I thought too, when I'm seeing these pictures and stuff, or even as we're shooting it, you know, I can see it on the monitors that have a quick and dirty color grade. They have a LUT on them to make them look a little more like what the movie's going to look like. But part of it is you have to use your imagination. So I'm using my imagination in my head as a participant with no control, just a random person looking at a monitor of the way I choose to interpret what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's still so many steps that can become anything.
Right.
And very rarely did the movie it looked like we were making on the day wind up really looking like the thing that was the final product. Every time I thought like, oh, we're getting a little closer, I kind of see what this is going to be. It turned out there were still a million steps.
And that seems fascinating to me too, because like to go back to from script to direction to finished product, like I don't even know how anybody could have possibly maintained or predicted the vision that became those scenes with Herbert and Missy and the green screen superimposed.
Oh, yeah.
Those scenes to me, I mean, I'm watching it and I'm like, there's no way that this was an intentional move. I mean, like, obviously this was done on purpose, but this couldn't have been script level. You know, like nobody could have manufactured this vision because it's just absolute chaos. I mean, it seems like, I mean, like, is that making sense? Like, I can't imagine.
You know
imagine.
What's amazing about that, though? Because it's a VFX shot.
Yeah.
Those had to be really specifically done.
Yeah.
Which I know seems nuts because they look like. So the VFX, if you've seen the movie and you actually listened to what I said and didn't cheat, the VFX are really rudimentary looking. So much so that they had difficulty when they were putting them together to get them to look that bad.
Yeah.
That was actually a fucking problem.
Sure.
Most of them, with the exception of one sequence, most of them are actually true to form of what was written to what came out to the end more than anything in the movie, which I know looks insane.
Oh my God.
Looks like that can't be true. But I remember days on set, the one I cannot fucking forget is when they need the footage, because they're comping one thing on top of the other. So they have to kind of shoot the same positions, which is why doing the, I think people get it. So the weirdest fucking thing to this day that I've ever seen shot is shooting Penn's footage that's going to be comped over Harry Hamlin's footage while Missy's character is fucking Harry Hamlin. Because it is, you are just watching Penn like fake an orgasm on a green screen with no one. It's so weird, man. It's so weird. And we're all watching it, and then Adam would call cut and everyone would turn and look at each other and just sort of go, I think that's it. What are we making? Yeah. I don't really know what the, because you have all these professionals who are working on it. The crew had all worked on stuff before. And it just, especially, I was with the script supervisor who really kind of guards the continuity and that job is too much minutia to really explain here, but that's part of it, is really figuring out the continuity and sort of making sure that the director's getting what he thinks he's getting, mm-hmm. kind of. I don't know if I'm mm-hmm. explaining that well, but really getting to know her as this movie went along. And actually we had three different script supervisors at different points, and just figuring out, is that the shot that we meant to get? Is that the, usually, okay, say you're shooting dialogue. I'm talking and you're talking in a scene.
Mm-hmm.
We have maybe a wide of the both of us and a master talking. And then we have over my shoulder pointing at you, over your shoulder pointing at me. Very conventional. And someone would check off some boxes and go, we got all three. That's going to cut together. We can go to the wide. Then we can put the camera on for Michael's reaction. Then Eric makes a little joke. We got all that footage.
Mm-hmm.
But then imagine that there's a story within a story, and all the stuff is getting comped together, and half of it's on a green screen. And also the green screen needs to be like wrinkled and not
mm-hmm.
set up mm-hmm. right. Because if it's set up right, then
it looks more, it's easier.
You won't
to comp.
Be able to tell it yeah. was supposed to be
poorly
a bad
done.
Green, yeah. green screen shot, yeah. right? So you have yeah. to be like getting the frame outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was really crazy and hard. The one thing though where it did work the other way, and this goes all the way back to what we were talking about at the beginning, but what they started to realize, I think, through the edit, I liked the edits. But again, Adam's got a way better handle on this. You know, he's deep in the story. He's made a bajillion movies. He knows how a narrative unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going over there and watching the edit sometimes, and he's going, so is this making sense? Like, is this working? And I'm going, yeah, I get all of it. I was not thinking at the time, well, I was there when it was made and I read the script and it's been explained mm-hmm. to me 100 times.
Yeah.
I couldn't put myself in the position of a person who just turned on a movie on TV.
Right.
And also I knew it kind of was going to be challenging and confusing. So there was figuring out like just how much.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a huge shift in the narrative, because what they, this is my best representation, I think, of what they believe, is that you have this movie knocked off, which, as you said, is not a real movie. And that kind of need, you need to be able to see where that whole movie's narrative goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you do. I think most of that's there. And then there is this element of Penn's version of that that's recut. And you kind of need to see where Penn's character's taking it. Although it doesn't need to totally work, because he sucks at making movies and that's part of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he really controls what you're seeing. But then there is, who is Herbert Blount and what is that character's story? Herbert Blount is a guy who is crazy, wants to make movies, kidnaps a woman. So there's this whole element of what Herbert's thinking and ultimately the conclusion he comes to about himself and the actress Missy Pyle. And I think what they realized is that that most outside narrative, that that character needed a story,
mm-hmm.
that he couldn't just be some guy you run into who says, hey, let me show you a weird movie I made.
Right.
That you're going to go, well, who is this weird guy? Is this kind of making sense?
Totally.
So like where the movie ends, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how he has that whole monologue, and there's sort of this championship of championing of what filmmaking really means.
Mm-hmm.
That's that character, the character we never actually get a good look at until the very end.
Right.
That's that dude's story.
Mm-hmm.
And that really turned out to be what is the actual story of the movie Director's Cut.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if, honestly, up to that point, juggling all the different narratives, if anybody had really thought, oh yeah, this guy needs a whole arc here to do something.
Sure. Yeah.
So that put a screeching halt on the edit,
mm-hmm.
at which point they designed that entire dream sequence, the really far out trippy one where like mm-hmm. Harry Hamlin has horns and is sticking his tongue out
mm-hmm.
and like everything's spinning and exploding.
Yeah.
That was literally assembled out of nothing. There were no reshoots. That wasn't in the script. It was just decided that a dream sequence was needed. Usually what happens in that case is you need to go shoot a scene. If you absolutely mm-hmm. need a scene, what usually happens is you don't get it, or you try to cobble it together somehow, or convince yourself that it's not what you need. But in this case, because of the mechanism of, and this is something that's totally lost in the film. Nobody knows this story. It's not like it's just in the presentation of the movie itself, but this was one of the interesting parts of the experiment as filmmakers, is because the film looked the way it did, it really allows somebody to just make up a scene out of whole cloth using almost nothing new. The only new stuff was Penn's voiceover, because they could record that whenever they want, which also became a way they kind of shaped that narrative totally in the edit.
Yeah.
But they just took a bunch of scenes of them running and different stuff that was going to be used for one reason you either saw or got cut out of the movie, and then comped it together in some intentionally bad VFX craziness and created a psychedelic dream sequence that was not on the page, that was not filmed, that was literally never anywhere on Earth and just birthed it.
It never existed until it was in the movie, yeah.
That's crazy.
It is
crazy.
That's
insane.
Yeah.
Wait, it's like not even possible to do. And so that kind of led into a new, you know, a new ending on that as well. And I think that was, that's probably my biggest takeaway that I don't think somebody could get from the film, is just how much of that could be crafted because of the experiment. It was the most interesting, to me, the most interesting result of the experiment that does not wind up as a narrative.
Clear. Yeah, evident, right.
Yeah, layer of the film itself. That's some stuff about Director's Cut.
That was, yeah.
I guess. Like
there's more, but yeah, that was good. That felt good. I feel like I learned a lot. I mean, people should watch it for real. Like, this is, I don't mean this as somebody who is
we are also
partner
trying
of
to
somebody
hawk
who made
some,
the movie, but I do actually think it's a movie that you need to see. People need to see this movie. I watched it. I enjoyed it. I lied to you. I didn't get a chance to watch with somebody else because, you know, like double feature happens by the skin of my teeth on a weekly basis.
Sure. So. Sure. We're basically watching the movies as we talk about them. Time is so fucking constrained.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you want to move to that movie you finished 29 minutes ago?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely do. I definitely do want to move to that. That is called Everybody Wants Some with Dos exclamation,
two exclamation points, right.
One of those was a real Spanish word. Mm-hmm. One was not.
I made $121 on this movie.
Okay, that's good. That is actually higher, although there may be a Texas law, that is higher than SAG scale.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got some overtime.
Oh, overtime.
I went overtime.
So that's one day. You were shooting one day on this.
One single day.
Okay.
Yeah.
You played pool in this movie?
I did. That, I mean, that's my character's name is Pool.
Good. I caught you. I had to pay so much more attention to this movie than I even usually have to when I'm fucking studying, taking notes on a
movie.
Did
you see me all three times or just playing pool?
Oh, I only saw you playing pool.
Yeah, I'm in that scene like three. Like I teleport, which is hilarious to me. Because
are
like
you
in
wearing
the
same shirt every time?
Yes, unbelievably.
Right. I was
they let
watching
me get away
for
with
the,
that, and the same mustache. I'm wearing the same mustache the whole time.
The thing that really quick, we may end up doing 24 minutes on your mustache. If you've ever wanted to know everything about the guy playing pool and Everybody Wants Some, this is the right show. And really, at this point, we've made it this far. Why the fuck not? But the thing that I've been excited to watch this for so long because it was just like, you know, all this stuff was going on with Director's Cut and I'd get to gab at this all the time. And suddenly you're like, guess what? I made a movie.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? I want to know about this. And I think you made a bigger budget movie and a fucking Richard Linklater movie. And so this was really interesting to me. And then I was trying to imagine you in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the fuck I look like in a movie either. So whatever. But I'm just trying to go like Michael in this movie and it's like a throwback movie from some period.
Yeah.
How the fuck is this going to look? And you look more like you belong in that period than any human in the movie.
I know. I know. That's how I got cast, dude. Like I was walking down the street and someone was like, hey, send this person an email with a picture of your head. And I was like, okay.
To a point where I was just like, that's Michael.
Yeah.
Like as someone who has made...
Like everything around me makes more sense, but I'm still the same guy.
As someone who has made films with you, I felt a little bit of like a personal shame. Like, like why aren't I making like 70s period films with Michael? That's clearly what's meant to be done.
Yeah.
But also you're a way better background actor than I am. I believed you were playing pool. You're hanging out with that dude.
Yeah.
You guys had matching shirts.
That guy was a dick. He was a total prick and he was like really creepy.
But you know what? I bought it. I bought your chemistry.
Yeah, that's good. That's important. That's important.
Yeah.
Fun thing about that. This is a fun anecdote that I get to share. I'm too good at pool for that scene. And my one note, my face to face, you know, you get notes from a director based on your performance. They'll deliver notes, you know.
I had to do 49 takes of falling down, so I know about getting some notes.
Yeah, so I got some notes. But my main critique from Richard Linklater, literally, I wish I could say verbatim, but it was to the effect of, "You're too good at pool, man. You're going to need to start missing them. The balls are too loud."
Oh, that's the man. There's so much to filmmaking that's like you talk about these big things, but then on the day, it's like you're all just staring at each other, making like mouth breathing sounds, trying not to like.
They were fake pool balls. They were already rubber pool balls, but I was sinking them with such ferocity that they were still clattering over Wyatt Russell's dialogue.
Oh my God!
No, that whole scene, that was amazing to me because that so that whole saloon, that kind of 80s rockabilly with the bull riding, like scene.
Is the movie 80s or 70s? I guess
it's set in 1980.
Okay,
so both. Yeah. It's the Venn diagram.
That's how he pitched it. It's a Venn diagram film.
Well, no, he pitched it as it's kind of like Dazed and Confused, but 10 years later with a different cast.
Right.
And then I watched it, and spoiler alert, by the way, I think this movie is really good, and I'm legitimately surprised.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
I also like that you don't have to explain anything to anyone for your movie. You just put it in and watch it, and that's enough.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's a nice thing to be able to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, Richard Linklater's made a bajillion movies, and he knows, you know, how to about narrative.
Sure, right.
You know, the whole Oscar thing.
Don't need any VO. Good. It's good.
But that whole scene, that was like one of the most mind-boggling film moments for me. And maybe it's the one thing that I have insight into that maybe you don't, because of the sheer amount of money being pumped into that place. So
do you know, do you happen to know what the budget of this movie looked like?
Any idea? Don't. I think I had looked it up at one point. It was greater than $10 million.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Shot.
Yeah. Well, just look at the number of fucking people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here's what we know. We know two things. We know how many people were in the film and that they made at least $121
per day. A day.
Did you get food? You got like a lunch?
Yeah, fuck yeah, I got food.
Okay. See, this is...
Yeah.
This movie cost a lot of money.
I also drank coffee from the crew coffee station and I got scolded.
Scolded or scalded?
Scold both. Okay. Extras weren't allowed to use... they had real creamer at the crew station. Extras had powdered creamer. And I thought that was shitty. So I walked past the line into the crew station.
Always sticking it to the man.
And I was like, I want real creamer. And I poured it in my coffee. And they were like, yo, your coffee's over there. And Wyatt Russell went, man, he just wants real creamer. Give him a break. And I was like, thank you, Wyatt Russell. And so we're best friends now.
Yeah.
But no, so the thing that really stood out to me about shooting that scene is, so let me paint a picture for you. I drive out, you know where, let me paint a picture for just you. You know, when we drove out to Manor, Texas to shoot the Gilbert Grape Water Tower?
Yes.
You remember how all society vanished and then slightly rose up again around Manor, Texas?
Water Tower.
Yeah.
Rose up,
So I drove halfway between here and Manor.
Yeah.
To a church where a bunch of people parked cars, and I walked inside and they said, you should have washed your hair. You need to shave your face. You need to put on these pants. And then they carted us by van to a VFW.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with VFW?
Yeah, it's
like
sure.
Okay. Just making sure. So it's basically like a local, it's a hall that's called, it's VFW stands for Veterans of Foreign Wars, but it's a local hall that's basically like, it's like a big open room. A lot of times they'll do fundraisers or like bingo or fish fries, you know, really, really down home, small town bullshit.
Yeah.
And they cart, you know, 200 people to this VFW, two vans at a time. And they corral us. And I mean, in a surreal sense, we had to like, they shoot horses, don't they? Like each pair off and dance. And then the best dancers got to keep dancing until they had chosen who was going to dance for that scene.
Yeah.
Very, very weird. But I remember you're out. It's the hot Texas sun. It's fields. All you can see around you is fields and this white siding on this square building. And they herd us in small chunks of humans because they need to do shooting different scenes. They need different people in the background, whatever. So I go in and I walk in the side door. And I mean, like, dude, you walk in the side door, you walk through a curtain, and you are in 1980 just, like, so fucking fast.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, sawdust on the floor, tables, that awning, a mechanical bull, a bar that's not even really in the building. I mean, like, when you see the scene with the pool tables and the square dancing and the picnic tables with the peanuts on them and all that shit, like, that was an empty room. It was square. There's a square cube. They put a fake ceiling in it. And not only that, but you walk in there and there's Richard Linklater on a crane in a tiny room.
Oh my God.
I mean, like the magic of filmmaking, the binary level of going from zero to magic filmmaking, walking in that door.
Yeah.
I mean, the palpable level of Hollywood magic for me in that moment, it was just, I mean, it was surreal, man. Like you walk in and it's just, I mean, like Richard Linklater literally with a bullhorn going quiet on the set, sure, extras totally, pipe down.
Totally.
We need to shoot this again. I mean, like with a crane, with a automatic camera rotating on it and like actors you've seen before. Like it's just like this amazing thing to walk into. And then just for the next 6 hours, watch that get peeled away, man. You just, it all goes away.
Yeah.
6 hours of being in that environment, and you're like, this is just another shitty job.
Well, that's the other thing that amazed me. I know you and I talked about that. There's shows somewhere, and I don't know where they are. Somebody help, John, help us with this, please.
Yeah.
But there's shows that went on while Director's Cut was being filmed,
mm-hmm.
I think. And I think I talked about some of this stuff. But man, I remember going there and, you know, I'm on a big fucking movie set. And then other people they're just punching a clock.
Yeah, man.
Another one mm-hmm. of these fucking BS horror movies mm-hmm. with no money.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get it at first, but then, because mostly I just fucking hung out. I was a tourist, you know?
Right.
I chatted with people. I just ate crafty. I hung out.
Mm-hmm.
But on the occasions where we didn't have enough people to shoot something, and it was like, oh, you want to be in this? Well, I'm not going to say no. Although I did resist, like the one where I'd fall down a lot, and they probably wish they would have said okay. But you can only fall down so many times before you're just like, okay, we're just falling down. Are we still making a movie? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. is this, you lose it.
Falling down the movie? No, it's not that
it's
either.
It's hard to stay engaged
yeah.
and
yeah.
stay in the, yeah. and the second you get there, yeah, it's really, you know, I don't know how early you were there or what your day looked like, but were you guys...
It was long.
How long between when you got there and when you started filming?
Oh, probably like 6 hours, maybe
yeah,
more.
See, that's the yeah. other thing, is you get there and everyone goes, ooh, it looks... Oh, I feel it. Oh, I'm in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sit in a chair for 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Just sit somewhere for 6 hours and tell me the magic is still there. It's mm-hmm. real fucking hard.
I mean, I'll tell you the point where the paint began to peel for me.
I like how our normal shows are just like Human Centipede 2, pinnacle of filmmaking. Every film is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all these wonderful, and then we get to make some movies and we're like, it's hot out.
I mean,
you don't have any creamer.
The point for me that the whole veneer began to crack was when Richard Linklater had to walk over to the extras behind the pool table, right?
Mm-hmm. Not your group. You guys were great.
Right. Well, I was paired off with this other guy. But everybody in the background of the background. He had to walk over to them in between takes and scold them for being chatty.
Oh, God.
And I was like, oh, my God, movies are a joke.
Yeah.
This is a teacher telling these college kids to quit yapping because we're doing something. Don't talk during class. You can talk after class.
Yeah, right.
And it wasn't just that that had to happen. It was that it was Richard fucking Linklater going, you guys, am I going to have to turn this barn around?
Yeah, because I
will turn this barn around if you guys don't quit chatting between takes.
Totally. Well, this is one of the things that I think actually helps preserve the magic is what you get to see in a movie like this. You know, Linklater's made a couple of these movies. We talked about Boyhood on the additional content, I think, right? Mm-hmm. That wasn't mm-hmm. a regular show.
Mm-hmm.
Patreon.com/double feature. So Boyhood was also talking about a lot of the magic of growing up. It was, in a lot of ways, the ultimate coming of all ages movie. It was a cinematic feat that had never been before achieved, like every other fucking movie on double feature. But when you're actually, a movie like Everybody Wants Some has so many fucking people in these parties are just actual parties I've been to can't get that many people to go to them.
Mm-hmm.
So corralling that many people, I mean, you're still making film and all the theoretical and faux philosophical ways we talk about it. But also there's this huge fucking problem of just getting 200 goddamn people to do the right thing.
And it's human wrangling. Do you remember, I mean, to go back to another movie we made, do you remember the minimum amount of human wrangling we had to do on the double feature movie?
Oh, yeah. A scene we ended up not even using.
We had all those strangers come into my house.
It's like eight people.
And we were like, can you all sit here? You sit like this and I'll pretend you're doing this thing. Don't worry. We can't really explain why. Just do that. Also, we bought you all pizza, to which everybody said, we're good. We're just here for the experience.
Yeah.
And we went, really? I guess that's a whole pizza for me.
Right. That was our entire budget was pizza.
Yeah.
Pizza and tacos was our whole fucking budget for that movie. Oh my God. Yeah. So, I mean, well, that's what I was saying about preserving the magic, though, is the thing that's magical is a film, I think, is a lot like the way you remember an event.
Sure.
You know, a better time in your life, an old relationship you had, that probably, you know, an old job that like sucked a lot, but you don't remember that. You remember it through the magical fog of time past.
And I would go one further. I think it's less even... I think there's even less of a mystique to it because, and this is kind of fucked up, but it's the reality here, is like your memory of being on the set for Director's Cut and my memory of being on the set for Everybody Wants Some, like it'll get cloudy, it'll fade, you and I will die. And what won't is Director's Cut and Everybody Wants Some.
Sure.
And the veneer will completely restore itself in 50 years. I mean, that's it, right?
Well, because the veneer is not...
Somebody's going to watch Everybody Wants Some.
Yeah.
And they're going to be like, that must have been a great movie to film. Because there's no reason not to think that. There's no reason to think that the extras were like kicked off of having real Creamer.
Well, because the coordination... I'll try to fucking like wrap up one goddamn stray thought in this whole show. I'm so sorry. But the coordination between bringing all these people together, you know, you might look at this magically and go, wow, Richard Linklater must love working with people who are in their 20s and really like staying in that mental place. And, you know, the way that Quentin Tarantino loves hanging out with black people, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's just the space he's in that makes him feel good. But in reality, where Linklater is living in this movie is on the page. When there are 20-somethings on the page, that's the fog.
Yeah.
What's being written on the page, what's intended to be in the film, is the fog of the memory of what it was like back then.
It's the snapshot.
And then you get on the set. And
those 20-somethings won't shut up between takes.
Yeah, which is hard because you have to also not lose your will to... to like like basically put up a disc to lie to people, to gaslight what 20 somethings are. Mm-hmm. You have to show up, get them to actually be your fantasy of what they are, and also not lose the, not have an awakening where you go, wait a second, 20 somethings are really fucking annoying. And I have nothing as a 50 year old man or whatever. How old is Richard Linklater? That's probably close, yeah, right? Probably 40s 60, or something. Yeah. 40 to 60. That's, I went lower, you went higher. I was trying to.
I've seen him.
All right. So, you know, he has to not go, fuck it. This isn't like all of this nostalgia is, it's all nonsense, and throw the whole thing down. He has to persevere through the reality check that is actually showing up with these people and doing this thing. And that's another just completely unsung part of fucking filmmaking. Completely unsung.
Mm-hmm.
We have a website. We have to get the fuck out of here. Website is doublefeatureshow.fm. Doublefeature.fm.
Doublefeature.fm.
Oh my God. Have I been doing this whole time? That's because it doesn't matter. The website is patreon.com/doublefeature. And as much as I like my executive producer credits, I'd like to give these people theirs. That's Athena Banks, Tom Leonard, Keisha, Mark Abbott, Abbott of Unreason, Jordan Sells, David Anderson, Charles Crawford, Ben Ecker, and Aaron Shore. Relationships that will last a lifetime.
Did you catch previous executive producer Lexi Love in Director's Cut?
Did I catch her?
I'm just kidding.
Okay, yeah. I did actually just see her at the premiere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what gets lost to time. I can't expect that people listening to this have been listening forever, but that's how I met her, was way back.
Yeah.
She was the first person I met on Director's Cut, and she would then go on to be a executive producer on our show.
Stop talking. Ask me what we're doing next week.
Time to go. What are we doing next time on Double Feature?
Next time on Double Feature, it is the violent resurgence. It's the acid reflux of presidents and propaganda. You thought it was going to stay down, but it's coming back up one more time.
Oh my God.
And that hearty burp is going to come in the form of Jackie from 2016 and a very, very hard to swallow film called The Horrible Wonderful Life of Leni Riefenstahl.
Get back to the pretension here on Double Feature. Important.
Yeah.
Important.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Yeah. Pound a bottle of Maalox and join us next week. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.